All right, so just taking it from yesterday, we did a medium-sized calculation in which we actually obtained what's the leading order correction to what's the leading order signaling term. So if we use two detectors, two particle detectors to signal each other, we have an antenna A in the past, we have an antenna B in the future, they switch on, and they use the quantum field to communicate, to exchange information. We found that A, the leading order mechanism, has no classical analog. The usual way in which people think about these things often is, oh yeah, detector A emits a photon, detector B captures a photon. Well, that thing is subleading. That's not the leading order contributions to communication. That's a fourth order kind of process because it's tough to emit a photon, it is tough to capture it. The two things happening at the same time, it's even more tough. Now, we saw that there is something like a Casimir-like interaction that enters at order two, which is lambda A, lambda B. That is not, does not involve the exchange, the direct exchange of energy between sender and receiver. And we saw that it was a little bit funny. Well, first we computed this, we found that this is approximately proportional to, I mean, the thing is I'm missing some of the elements in the integral and just keeping the essential ones. So we had that it was proportional to the commutator on the support of the interaction, spatial and temporal, which means that, of course, this term is causal. The communication cannot happen if A and B are space-like separated, as expected, obviously, the theory is causal. And we also found, interestingly, that this term was non-zero only if there were coherences in the initial state. If the initial state of the antenna was classical, the emitter was classical, as in like either an eigenstate of energy or a statistical mixture of ground and excited state, then this term would not contribute. So this term only shows up if you are working with quantum antennas and you actually prepare a state that has some degree of quantumness in the sense of coherences in the initial state. Any questions about that? Just recapping what we did yesterday. All right. So now we're going to analyze the consequences of something like this. And in particular, I'm going to focus, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about when this can be funny or unexpected, I guess. And then we're going to talk a little bit about implications in cosmology. And we will play a little bit with that. And hopefully, if I have time today, and if not, it'll be the beginning of tomorrow's lecture, we also analyze from the point of view of signaling the so-called rotating wave approximation to see how the rotating wave approximation breaks causality. As an approximation is bad for relativity. All right, so let's begin. We were saying that there are several conceptions about wireless communication that we're challenging here. And in particular is these ones. So information propagates arbitrarily slow, even for massless fields, that's something unexpected. You would expect that information through massless fields propagates only at the speed of light, not faster, but definitely not faster, but probably not slower either, because a massless field is not that you can throw a rock. Another conception is, well, if I beam someone with a laser and that person is not present, if someone comes here the year after and sits there, they're not going to be able to recover any information from that message because they missed the beam. And I was arguing that maybe that's not entirely true in all its generality. We will see in what sense. We also discussed that often is conceived that, well, if you send information, at least on average, it would have to be supported by some energy carrier. The energy carriers carry the information too. And I was arguing that, no, that's actually not true in general either. And that means that you can have actually information flows in the absence of energy flows, okay? And this is the, I get this here because of the word like afterglow. So it seems that we're gonna discuss about having an atom interact with a quantum field may leave a residue, a signal, a remnant on the field that is not related with energy flows propagating, and that can be read later on by someone else that couples to the field. Not always, but in some cases, and we will see what cases. In fact, from the mathematical point of view, in most cases, as we will argue. Question so far? All right, so let's see what's behind this that I'm talking about. Have you ever heard of the strong Huygens principle? You probably have heard about the Huygens principle. who can tell me anything? What do you remember? What's the Huygens principle? Does anyone remember that? It's related to the, so the Huygens principle, it's optics. Oh, you can tell me, yeah, tell me. That's right. So light adds a source of light, meaning that the Strong-Huygens principle would tell you that in whatever equations propagate light, the green function, the radiation green function, has support only on the light cone. It's generated by light. That's the Huygens principle. The Strong-Huygens principle is the generalization of this to differential equations in general. In particular, the Strong-Huygens principle, we define it as this. The Green's function of the massless wave equation in 3 plus 1 Minkowski space. This is the Huygens principle again. In 3 plus 1 Minkowski space has support only on the light cone. Hence, any disturbances propagate strictly along null geodesics at the speed of light. This is Huygens principle. Now, this is true. This is a theorem. By the way, who remembers or knows the relationship between the field commutator and field Green's function? Question, is the field commutator a Green function? It is a Green function. You remember which one? It's the radiation Green function. It would be the retard in the future and the advance in the past. So it's the retarded minus the advance. Okay, that's the commutator. It's called the radiation Green function. The radiation Green function, this commutator here, or the expectation of the commutator here, has indeed, in 3 plus 1 D flat spacetime, indeed has support only strictly on the boundaries of the light cone because satisfies this. But one can wonder, so in that case, right, if this thing is only supported on the light cone, on the boundaries of the light cone, there's none of those unintuitive behaviors that I actually said before. Because, communication will only happen on the light cone, not inside the light cone. Okay, because this thing will not be supported inside the light cone either. Now, one can wonder how general is this. So there's some restrictions here, right? There's 3 plus 1D, Minkowski. What happens if I start relaxing that? How general it is? Oh, well, the phrase that is missing here is this is not true in general. It's actually true only for particular, very particular cases. And when this is not true, one can wonder, can we actually use this to communicate? And the answer is, if you have classical antennas, this is a pretty classical theorem. Can you use, so the Green function may have support inside the light cone. Can you use classical antennas to communicate? No. But what if you have quantum antennas? Well, if you have quantum antennas, seems that you can. All right? Now, that is supposed to say here that is not really very general, a theorem, or at least how strong it is if we start perturbating these things. In particular, for 1 plus 1D, it's horribly wrong. It's like the commutator inside the light cone is as strong anywhere inside the light cone as it is on the boundary. And 2 plus 1D is non-zero. In 3 plus 1D is zero. In 4 plus 1D is not. In 5 plus 1 is zero. And 6 plus 1 is not. So in an odd number of spatial dimensions in flat spacetime, this principle, the Strong-Huygens principle is satisfied. If the number of spatial dimensions is even or 1, then it's not satisfied. What about curved spaces? Well, in general, not satisfied. In fact, there's a branch of mathematics, there's a field of research in math that is basically about finding cases when this principle holds. They're so rare that the news, the publishable result is, I found a spacetime that for the massless wave equation, this is satisfied. Minkowski in odd spatial dimensions larger than 1 is a rare exception. Okay? All right. Questions? Okay. We live in a very rare exception. And optical fibers are also not satisfying this kind of thing either, interesting enough. All right, so I'm not going to get into the technological, if you want, sci-fi technological applications. Instead, let's focus on the more fundamental Because I said that an optical fiber would not satisfy the strong Huygens principle. So in principle, you can just send a signal, let it propagate through the fiber, and they get people, I don't know, later on, to connect to the fiber at the same time, and all of them extract information from it. Of course, classical. All right? Anyway, but let's not focus on that, and let's talk a little bit about cosmology and what implications this has in cosmology, or more concretely, about how much information we can gather from early stages of the universe. So, again, strong Huygens, here's the commutator. Commutator is equal or is proportional to the radiation Green function. It's kind of like some misconceptions usually about, so when we have something like the Green function, the radiation Green function, such as the commutator, or the Feynman propagator, all those things are Green functions, which means they're solutions of the, did I have it here? Yes, solutions of that. Then non-homogeneous, delta-sourced Green equation. Now, the Wyman function looks a lot like the Feynman propagator, does it not? You remember the Wyman? The Wyman is the expectation, if you want, of twice the field, the two-point correlator. The Feynman propagator is the same with a time ordering. Well, they're very different in nature. The Wyman function is not a Green function. The Wyman function is actually a kernel. What that means is that it would be the solution to the Green equation with a zero in here, not with a source. So it's important, maybe not to follow things that I'm saying, but to get into like more depth into how these things, how detectors actually behave with coupled to fields, it's really important to have clear what is a Green function and what is a kernel, okay? Because they have different properties. There are many of them the same, because after all, one is a solution to the homogeneous equation, the other one is a solution to the inhomogeneous equation, and it's a linear equation. So they are related indeed, okay? But they're not the same. Anyway, so, right, if we have that the strong Huygens principle is satisfied, then communication has support only on the boundary of the light cone. And that's the case for 3 plus 1 flat spacetime, as we said. But in general, if there's curvature, unless there is conformal symmetry, full conformal symmetry, and we will talk about it, conformal fields are boring in that sense with respect to the strong Huygens principle. We will talk about what that means. Unless you have that, then in curved spacetimes in general, communication through massless fields is not confined to the boundary of the light cone. There is a leakage of this thing, of the field commutator inside the light cone, in the time-like area of the light cone. All right. So let's consider a case that is simple and still interesting. Let's consider FRW and FRW, FLRW. Do I have the L? No. That's sad. Lemaître was a friar, and he's always forgotten, and he developed the whole thing independently. Anyway. An L in here. Homogeneous and isotropic cosmology. So you get this FRW-like FLRW metric, and then we say, okay, fine. Let's say that the geometry is generated by a perfect fluid with this equation of state, with a constant ratio of pressure to density, okay? As usual in the models. The scale factor, of course, evolves like this, and is, of course, the evolution of the scale factor with conformal time eta is a function of this speed of sound of the fluid, if we want, W. W is the speed of sound of the fluid. All right. So let's have, in this background, a test scalar field that is quantized in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, okay? So the kind of usual way in which people do quantum field theory in cosmology. How much do you know about that? I don't know how much you've heard about these things. Have you heard about these things before? How many people have? Okay, not many. Okay, maybe I'll talk a bit about this. So in cosmology, so in general, if you have in flat space-time, you have a lot of luxuries. In particular, you have one, which is the existence of a time-like Killing vector field. That allows you to define, and you have a privileged way, if you want, to define a quantization scheme, to define a vacuum. Vacuum, yeah, vacuum is the ground state according to observers that go with the time-like symmetry. And that's what you call the vacuum of the theory. The Minkowski vacuum that we talked about is the vacuum with respect to observers that go with partial t. With partial t is the time-like Killing symmetry. Now, of course, different people will define different vacua. We saw the Andrew effect. Someone that goes with partial t, therefore velocity is partial tau, sorry, corresponding to the boost generator, someone that is constantly accelerated, that person will not see, will not agree that the vacuum for Minkowski is the vacuum. They would have a different notion of vacuum. However, the fact that we have a time-like Killing vector defining the whole space-time allows you to define a kind of an objective quantization, the quantization for inertial observers. Okay? Now, in curved space-time in general, you do not have a time-like Killing vector field everywhere. So you do not have a good reason to declare that one vacuum is better than another. And that's important, right? Because in Minkowski, we want that to say, right, the initial state is the ground state, very low temperature. Well, we know what we mean by that. We mean like, yeah, inertial observers will not see a lot of particles in it. Because inertial observers are privileged. Ah, you see, this kind of formulation of special relativity says there's no privileged observers. That's not true. There are privileged observers, inertial observers. They're privileged with respect to the other ones. In fact, they will measure the speed of light to be seen always. Something that you cannot say as such for any non-inertial observer. Anyway, yeah, those people would say, yeah, when we say the ground state of the theory, no one doubts. Does anyone have any doubt when I say we have the vacuum state of the field? You all know what I'm talking about, no? That's unambiguous. Well, it's unambiguous because we're in flat space-time. And in flat space-time, inertial observers that carry have for velocity partial t, those observers define a vacuum, and we give it importance. We think, no, that's the vacuum. If you see particles, because you're accelerating, but the inertial observers see nothing, we call that the vacuum. Right. What happens if you're in a space-time that you don't have that? How do you privilege observers? Not only that, the metric, as you see here, is not time-independent. Well, I mean, it's like similar anyway. Explicitly not time independent. So depending when you ask, the vacuum will be different. So what I call the vacuum not only depends on the observer, it depends, the same observer at different times will not agree with the past self of what the vacuum is. So this is a problem in general when we do quantum field theory. If you have heard anything about black holes and quantum fields, you may have heard things such as the Bolwer vacuum, the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, the Andrew vacuum. Have you heard those things? Maybe not, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you've covered things like that in your PSI courses, but defining a vacuum in curved spaces is tough. Tough as in like, which one is physical? Well, I don't know. I don't have a good reason. So yeah, Bolwer and Hartle-Hawking vacua, when you define them in black hole backgrounds, you say, oh yeah, one of them is singular at the horizon. So I don't want that one because there's an infinite number of particles at the horizon for someone that falls. I don't like this one. What about one that is regular there? Yeah, but happens to be singular at infinity. Oh man, that's not good. Okay, how about some hybrid of the two that is kind of regular at the horizon and regular at infinity, but you pay other prices to it? Anyway, this is the whole debate between Bolwer, Hartle-Hawking, and Andrew vacua. And that's something that if you are into the black hole information problem and firewalls and stuff like that, you need to care about those things. So the main point here is to be aware that the vacuum, there's no way to define objectively a vacuum, which is the same as define a quantization scheme, huh? Because define a vacuum is defining annihilation operators that will annihilate that vacuum, that will canonically commutate with creation operators that are there adjoint. And that allows you to quantize. It's like in reverse. Define a vacuum and a quantization scheme is the same thing. Now, in curved spacetimes, we need reasons to define a vacuum because it's not enough. There's no common sense notion of vacuum, if you want, that we have in flat spacetime. So in cosmology in particular, what do we call a vacuum? What is a nice vacuum? You see, that's a problem. So we need conventions. We need reasonable conventions. One of them is what is called the adiabatic vacuum. So the adiabatic vacuum is like, OK, I want maybe there are some states that if I define a vacuum in the asymptotic past, it will remain a vacuum throughout until the asymptotic future. If you can do that, we call that actually the conformal vacuum. If you have full conformal symmetry, that would be actually true. So if your field is conformally coupled and you have full conformal symmetry, you can define that vacuum. Kind of makes sense because it's like, yeah, there's a notion of vacuum that remains always. Let's call that the common sense vacuum. And this is considered an initial state for fields everywhere. When you do quantum gravity coupled to fields and so on, that's what people tend to consider if they have conformal symmetry. If not, well, the best you can do is say, okay, among all the possible vacua, There's one that, if I define it in the asymptotic past, will generate the smallest number of particles in the asymptotic future. It will be the closest possible to vacuum in the future as I evolved. That is the adiabatic vacuum, and in particular, well, the Banchevich vacuum. So the Banchevich vacuum is basically, let's take as the vacuum something that has no particles in the asymptotic past, and then as I evolve, if you want, I have the smallest possible number of particles as I evolve in time. This is done in books often and justified more or less okay or not, depending on your how picky you are, I guess, because this is physics, it's not math. Defining a vacuum is physics. And as such, it depends on what your assumptions are, and you postulate things. You're making assumptions to define a vacuum. It's reasonable, yes, because you know what? Most of the vacua actually diverge in the number of particles, uncontrolled. So this doesn't seem physical too much to define a vacuum that will evolve to have an infinite number and control in that diverging kind of way number of particles. This one at least is controlled. So at least it's not non-physical, if you want. Huh? And sometimes that's the best you can do. Okay, if you want to see discussions about this, you need to go to books like Birrell and Davis. They talk about it. Satisfactorily or not, I will leave it to your judgment. We can talk about it if you read it there, and I'll be happy to discuss about it. But anyway, we need to pick a vacuum and a quantization scheme, which is tough. Doing quantum field theory in curved spaces, sadly, is not easy. It can be done, it's not easy. But connecting it to physics is the most difficult part, because we don't have a notion of objective vacua, which is what we have in Minkowski. When I tell you the vacuum, everyone's like, all right. Here, when I tell you the vacuum, you should ask, which one and why? Okay? Good. That clarified. Now, I hope you have some intuition now what I mean by this. I mean some physically motivated choice of vacuum that people use. I think that may be probably the best. And that is definitely reasoned in the fact that the number of particles created and so on will not diverge uncontrollably, and, well, it's got nice properties that make it more physical than others. All right. Now, that clarified. Now, we have, in this background, we have a scalar field that is quantized in the Banchevich vacuum, okay? And then we couple it to the background geometry. How do we couple it? Oh, this is an unruly detector that you already know. Okay, how do we couple it? We will see later, but we're gonna couple it in two different ways. We're gonna couple it conformally and minimally. Have you seen those things before? What's Klein-Gordon equation in curved spaces in general? The fact that you can have coupling to curvature too? To the action, you can always add something that is a multiple of the Ricci scalar. And the proportionality constant defines different coupling to curvature. And if it's zero, we call it minimal coupling. Well, if it's a particular value that we will discuss, we call it conformal coupling, which is like, okay, what if we want the action to be conformal invariant, invariant under conformal transformations? Then you need to couple in a particular way to the background geometry. We will see that though. Again, we're gonna use for this, in this background, we have FLRW, space-time, and then we have a quantum field in it, and we're gonna do measurements in that field. Okay, we're gonna have matter interacting with it, or something quantum interacting with it, if you want. In particular, let's have unruly Witt detectors that you already know. Okay. And let the initial state of the detectors be like this, that I have on the board, I also have in the slide. A superposition, arbitrary superposition of pure dough, but arbitrary superposition of excited and ground. Okay, they are quantum detectors, if you want, so there's matter that is quantum, and it's coupled to the field starting with these initial states, okay? At the beginning of their interactions. Now, there's a little modification, which is, you so far we've been doing the integral over space, right? But then the integral over space is the integral over the element of volume. Then the element of volume in curved spaces has a determinant of the metric in it. Well, in this case, what you have is a scale factor. It's not surprising. The element of volume is expanding or contracting. All right, so that's the calculational difference with what you've seen, because now we have we don't have flat space then, okay? All right, so let's devise a protocol to try to exploit the nature of this Casimir-like interaction to communicate. So we're going to define something called signaling estimator. Signaling estimator is going to tell us about the influence of the presence of detector A on B. I'll define it properly later, but it's properly as in mathematically in a second. But this is basically a quantity that quantifies how much B notices A, okay? And we're gonna talk also about the notion of channel capacity. Have you seen those when you saw quantum info? I'm hoping, no, maybe not. Okay, channel capacity in general, I mean, channel capacity is a notion of classical information theory. Channel capacity tells you, it's a classical channel capacity I'm gonna talk about here, tells you how many bits per use of the channel. You have a channel, which is like a protocol that allows you to transmit information from A to B, and per use, independent use of the channel, how many bits per use can you transmit, literally. That's the literally channel capacity, okay? And we're gonna compute the channel capacity for a particular protocol from a detector A to a detector B using this kind of thing. So how many bits per second? That's the kind of thing that the number of, the, so that's the kind of thing that you, when you're downloading something, when it tells you this transfer rate, that's kind of the channel, the capacity of the channel. Okay, so we're gonna compute that for communicating with this Casimir-like interactions. Now, this signaling estimator, let's pick a simple one that will adapt to the protocol we will use. Man, the red is really not easy to see, huh? Oh, sorry about that. So this is the probability of finding the detector excited. Detector B excited. There are three sources to that probability. Of course, the initial probability. Remember, the detector in B starts like this. So the modulus of alpha squared is the original probability of detecting it excited. If we do a perturbative calculation, there will be corrections over that, okay? Second contribution, what we call the local contribution, the one that I call noise in the notes, or vacuum here if you want, because we're gonna start in the bunch of this vacuum, I call it vacuum, but this is a noise contribution. In fact, in the papers about this, usually we call it R for noise. Anyway, so the probability of excitation here, this is independent, that's the one that was independent of lambda A, so it was the lambda B squared kind of term, okay? Something that doesn't have information whatsoever about the presence of A, okay? And then finally, this is S of T. This S is, well, the correction to the probability that is proportional to lambda A, lambda B. If lambda A is there, it will be there. If detector A is there, this contribution will be there. If it's not there, it won't be there, okay? So this is truly a signaling contribution, a correction to the transition probability coming from the presence of the correction to the transition probability of B coming from the presence of A. Clear? All right. So let's begin talking about, because of course there are several settings, and we're gonna see a couple of them. We're gonna see a bouncy one and a big one, big bang one, if you want. So let's begin with the big bang one. Let's just not involve funny things yet. So standard cosmological model, okay? So general relativity. We're not gonna involve anything like quantum corrections yet or anything like that. Let's have general relativity and let's see what happens here. So we have Klein-Gordon equation. As you see, so this is the Klein-Gordon equation in a curved spacetime. This is the coupling to curvature term in here. This coupling constant, we can have several, well, arbitrary value for sure. There are two particularly interesting ones. Conformal coupling, this is because of the number of dimensions that we have. Conformal coupling yields conformal invariant action. So if you want to couple the field without spoiling conformal symmetry, you would pick this value of the coupling to curvature. And then there's minimal coupling. Yeah, minimal coupling, this is funny. So we insist in keeping conformal symmetry often, but oftentimes in cosmology, people use minimal coupling because they get better, more handleable, more nicer results, not just simplicity, but also seems to give good predictions too. So minimal coupling, let's take it as a representative of not having conformal symmetry. Now, of course, I had a mass in here. This mass already breaks conformal symmetry. In order to have conformal coupling, conformal symmetry, you need to couple conformally, but also you need the mass to be zero, okay? So you can think of minimal coupling also being broken by interactions, conformal symmetry being broken by interactions by some small mass or whatever you want, okay? To have conformal symmetry, you need to be really, really fine-tuned, as in like, has to be massless and coupled in a very particular way to curvature. So in that sense, conformal coupling, beautiful as it is, and it's got conformal symmetry, and we know conformal symmetry is great for many reasons, it's a little bit fine-tuned, if you see what I mean. Okay, you need a lot of things to conspire to have conformal coupling, conformal symmetry. All right. We're going to consider several cases. We're going to consider cases where the spatial distance between A and B is fixed, and then they are separated temporally. So time went by, and then they communicate. One is in the full past, the other one is in the pure time-like future of the other. And the other one is when we have spatial separation. So we fix the time separation between them, and we vary the distance, how far they are. All right. All right, the signaling estimator. You have already computed that. Actually, you've computed more than that. You computed the full density matrix of Bob, if you remember. That's what we did yesterday. And I forgot what representation I used. Ground was 1, 0, excited 0, 1. Okay. So the lower diagonal element is the probability of finding the detector excited, if I am remembering the representation I used right. Okay, well, let's get that expression. So we can expand the signaling estimator in power series. And the first order correction to that is lambda I, lambda B, as we said. And it looks like this. This is from the density matrix that we had, that we computed yesterday. Again, look at this. This signaling estimator in particular is non-zero. Of course, if both elements of the superposition are non-zero, as expected, if we had an eigenstate, it would not work. Okay, this term will be exactly zero, as we knew. So we need the coherences in there. All right. And there's the commutator in there, in here. All right, so it is about to evaluating the commutator. So now, look at the commutator in the conformal coupling case. So massless and conformally coupled. 3 plus 1 dimensions. Look at the commutator. What does it look like? Boring or fun? How many people would say boring? I would agree with you, in the sense that this commutator here looks a lot like the commutator in 3 plus 1D, flat, only with a conformal factor. Surprise, surprise. So if we have conformal symmetry, the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation conformally transformed are the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation in the conformally flat spacetime. So if you have conformal coupling and your spacetime is conformally flat, you have strong Huygens principle, if the flat version has it. So if you have a spacetime that satisfies strong Huygens and you conformally transform it, and you feel this conformally coupled, you keep the conformal symmetry, then the strong Huygens principle carries to the other one. The commutator is just a conformally transformed commutator, two proportionally proportional conformal factors, or the square of the conformal factor. Okay? So you would not be able to communicate in the time-like region if you are conformally coupled in 3 plus 1 FLRW. Okay? Conformal coupling is too symmetric. What happens with minimal coupling? And before that, let's just define a communication protocol that we're going to use. And this communication protocol will yield some channel capacity. So the communication protocol is a very simple one. So channel capacity could be larger than this, but this is like very simple. I am Alice. Oh, I just hit the microphone. I am Alice, and I am to encode a 1. By I have a detector, and I can decide. I have it in a Faraday cage, if you want. I encode a 1 by opening the cage, coupling it to the field. And I encode a 0 by not doing it. That's it. That's my encoding bit. 1 is I couple to the field, a 0 I don't. Keep in mind that we're not using all the power. We can change the state and get a huge amount more of information, but let's just do the simplest. Okay, we send a 1 or a 0, and by sending that, what we do is coupling or not. And then Bob. Bob later on reads out, and the reading out of Bob is the same thing. So Bob has the detector in a Faraday cage, opens it and closes it, and then measures the detector. If the detector is in the excited state, writes down a 1. If it's in the ground state, writes down a zero. Okay? There's going to be information in the fact that the probability of finding a one or a zero is influenced by the presence or not of Alice. Okay? Because of the signaling estimator that we had, the correction to the probability. So this is what is called, in classical information theory, engineers do that, use it all the time. And that's the way that's the kind of channels that you use for Wi-Fi. So you have a probability, there's a probability of false readouts. So it's a noisy channel, there's noise in it. This is actually called noisy asymmetric binary channel. That's the name, and then there's an expression for that. I'm not gonna get into the informational theory out of, so basically the channel capacity is like, with this kind of protocol, what is the best you could do if you're clever with redundancy and sending many times and trying to battle the noise with the protocols, optimize over that, and you get an expression. And then that expression, of course, is a function of the transition probabilities, and it's a function of the signaling estimator, and we can expand it to leading order, and the channel capacity is order 4 in the couplings, and it's order s to the first correction to the signaling estimator square. Okay, that is the one of the few times that I asked you to trust me. But otherwise, we would need like several lectures to get over that, and more boring lectures, as in like, I don't know, depending on what you like. It's a combinatorics and optimization kind of lecture, why this is the expression that we would get for the channel. I'm not insinuating that's boring. I'm just saying that it's not the topic of what we're doing. Anyway, so if we trust that expression, let's go back and revisit the conformal coupling case. We had the commutator, pretty boring one, right? Supported only on the light cone, like the 3+1D. Well, in fact, it's the 3+1D flat commutator, only with a conformal factor, as expected. It decays with spatial separation, of course. What happens in the minimal coupling case? Oh, well, yes, that's exactly what I was saying. And literally what I was saying. All right. So in a minimal coupling case, the expression of the commutator, I wrote here the correction to the signaling estimator. And here's the commutator in the minimal coupling case. It looks complicated, right? I mean, not really, to be honest. But it's definitely complicated-ish, OK? So in the minimal coupling case, we get this expression here. There's a g with a hat here. It's not an operator, it's a function. Well, it depends how complicated this g is. It will be more or less complicated, right? Let's find out. Ah, so yeah, maybe not very nice, huh? In the minimal coupling case, well, it's nice in the sense that those are nice closed expressions. And this integral may or not may be possible to do analytically. Those are Bessel functions. So honestly, within all the bad things in the world, this is pretty nice. Now, there are particular cases where this thing simplifies a lot. For example, you have a matter-dominated universe. So if you have a matter-dominated universe, the Bessel functions here become trigonometrics, simple trigonometrics, that you can actually substitute in, integrate, and get an extremely nice expression. There we go. Look at this expression. That is the commutator and for a minimally coupled scalar field in a matter-dominated universe, making an assumption on the speed of sound of the fluid that sources space-time. So do you recognize one of the terms? This is the same term we had in the conformal coupling case, the one that is like flat space-time conformally transformed. Well, there's one that comes from the breakdown of conformal symmetry. And that one is particularly interesting. Let's compare. This one is supported only on the light cone, but this other term has kind of the same arguments as the deltas here, but they're thetas. That means that they do not cancel outside of the boundary of the light cone. This thing is supported within the time-like area. This thing violates explicitly the strong Huygens principle. Interesting enough, spatial decay, no spatial decay. This thing doesn't care too much about the coordinate distance between the detectors. I mean, still depends on conformal factors and the conformal time, but there's no decay with distance. All right, so here we have signaling estimators and channel capacities as defined before. But when we vary the spatial separation, we have a fixed temporal separation. And then we see these are the light cones, by the way. So this is the entrance on the light cone, the full light contact here. This is partial light contact. Okay, I should have had a scheme. So this is A. This is A is light cone. So you have B. This is one case. This is another case. This is, maybe I should do a smaller one, another case. And this is another case, all right? So you can be in space-like separation, partial light contact, full light contact, partial light contact again, or full time-like contact. All right, those are the different cases in here, in this plot. And as you see here, so this is space-like separation. In space-like separation, of course, in both cases, you cannot signal, zero channel capacity, zero signaling estimator, okay? And in the in here, so this is the minimal coupling case. So you see that when we have light contact, this grows. Look at the contributions. I actually separated them. So I'm plotting to the conformal case. This S delta is precisely only the delta term. So this is the total, the sum of the two terms, right? The contributions coming from the two terms. This is the contribution coming from the delta part of it, which is the same as the conformal coupling case. This is the extra contribution that we get in the minimal coupling. And this is the total of the two. So you see how in the case of a conformal coupling, you would only signal in light contact. And then in time-like, again, you fall down. There's no time-like communication. In the case of minimal coupling, you get contributions that add up to that. And in particular, the total is zero in space-like separation, but is constant with the separation in time-like separation, constant with the spatial separation. Channel capacity, same thing. This is in bits per use of the channel. We have put realistic kind of values here. Notice the 10 to the minus 13. Well, yes, per use of the channel. OK. That's already what I said. All right, variation with the temporal separation. With the temporal separation, there is a decay, indeed, as we see. But we have tails that maybe are not decaying too fast. So how fast do the tails decay? And can we do something about it? Well, the decay is actually subpolynomial. So the nice thing about that decay, though, is that you can actually, if you were like in a matter-dominated universe, you could compensate by deploying agencies of receptors, like receivers. You can deploy a surface, a lot of receivers, and deploy them in a surface, right? And then you increase the number of receivers with the surface. You increase the number of receivers like the square of the radius that you deploy the receivers. And that would compensate a decay like that. So in principle, you could use that. In fact, the important bit here, as we will see in a minute, is how close the first detector and the second detector are to the Big Bang in this Big Bang scenario. That is, everything else can be compensated. Now, I'm not going to get into the details here. I did it with matter dominated. If you have a cosmological constant dominated universe, so in the limit in a de Sitter universe, it doesn't even decay in time. And it's actually super simple to see where the cancellation comes from. In the de Sitter case, you have an exponential expansion. The time-like signal does not decay in space or time. It leaks up to the time-like area and remains that without decay. You cannot say the same about light signals. Light signals decay as fast as the area surface where the energy is being, because then in that case, it's energy carrying the information, where the energy is dispersed. I hope that this is provoking and makes you like look more into it. I'm very happy to discuss any questions you may have about this. All right. Any questions about this part, the Big Bang part? Interesting, though. So what I'm claiming here is that we have signals coming perhaps from the early universe physics that may not decay with the separation to the source in time, even. And they're not carried by light. Do you know, in cosmology, what we do so far is looking at light. That's what we do. We actually collect lights. So far, that's the only thing we collect. There might be other sources of information that are not just light. This is what he's saying. Maybe some other sources of information that have to do with, okay, imagine that you have an emitter in the early universe that was non-classical, that was in a superposition, and was emitting signals like this. Well, those signals you can capture if you use quantum antennas. Okay, that's the message on this. Think about it, and let's discuss it later on, or now if you want.
So will there be so many signals that we won't know what?
That's a good question. How do you discriminate signals? That's the same thing. You could say the same thing about light. Because when people look at sources, astrophysics, I'm not saying this is like tomorrow, I'm going to go to Astrophysics Institute and tell them, shh, you're doing everything wrong, do this. Not at all. But the point of separating signals is also a point that light carried signals also have. When you look at any source, you have plenty of signals signaling you, and you need to filter them, and you need to remove them, you need to do signal processing. Signal processing will be required. So some assumptions as to the origin of the emitter have to be made, and with those assumptions, filter everything else. Yes. So knowledge is known, is need to be known about the sources. There's the fact that there's no decay of the other signals makes it like, oh, it seems very intense stuff. But in principle, you would be able to discriminate. So with light, people do even more difficult than that. They have very, very faint sources, and they actually filter out really strong ones. So in principle, I don't see that as a road stopper, as a showstopper anyways. But then again, I'm not claiming, we will get to the end and the claims and all. I'm definitely not claiming that astrophysics have to just do that now, right now.
Can you remind us what we require of the quantum fields?
Say again?
What we require of the quantum field to do the signaling?
Not to have what we need for the cosmology case, you need not to have conformal symmetry. So anything that breaks conformal symmetry, the way we did it here is minimal coupling. A minimally coupling scalar field will violate Strong-Huygens. Now, minimally coupling would do it. Now, you can have breakdown of conformal symmetry in different other ways. Even if you have, I mean, to be honest, question one, should we demand conformal symmetry to begin with? Is there any good reason for it? I don't think there is. In fact, minimal coupling seems to be better for phenomenology. Second, if we had conformal symmetry, can it be broken in a different way, that is, there's no change in the coupling to curvature? Yes, indeed. Some interaction will do it for you. Or a small mass, maybe in the field, something that is like a tiny mass would be enough. Anyway, so yeah, you need not to have conformal symmetry. Conformal symmetry is too symmetric. The commutator is the same as C plus one flat plus times a conformal factor. You don't want that. All right. So the next scenario that we're going to look at, let's just do it in a fun way. How much information survives a cosmological cataclysm? Cosmological cataclysm is something like a bounce, like a big bounce. So the universe is contracting and reaches a volume such that the energy density is too high. And by too high, I mean really too high. So I don't have this thing. OK, I'll do it later. So this thing, I'm going to prepare you now, because I had the funny picture. I somehow didn't upload, so I'm sorry about that. So imagine the following scenario. So you want to transmit information from a source. Like, imagine, I don't know. This is the thing that I always tell. Imagine that you're an ancient civilization, and you're living in an era like, I don't know, how long has humanity had to develop, like as a sentient and sapient species?
100,000 years.
Sapient? I don't know. Sapient, I guess. Mm. Yeah, definitely that's definitely an upper bound. No more than that. Now, we can argue when we actually use tools, no, in a proper way and so on, but yeah, fine. Between tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands. Okay, imagine that you existed as a sapient species for trillions and trillions of years. So you master all physics, as much as you can master physics. So you know all the physics there's to know. And then you discover that your universe is contracting, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. The universe is going to contract very fast, and eventually, the energy density is going to reach limits where atoms cannot resist. Matter will not be able, like bound matter will not be able to resist it. I mean, it's too much energy density. There's no place for atoms to exist. But then you think, oh, wow, okay, what can we do? What would you do if you discover that your fate is to disappear? You existed for trillions of years and you're so stable that you know your species will resist forever if it weren't for kind of cataclysm that is difficult to avoid at the cosmological level. What would you do to survive? What would you try to do to survive? Can you do anything? Well, you know all physics, right? So you're clever. And you know that, I mean, regardless of the fact that the universe may be having too much energy density, you still have quantum fields in it. As in like, yeah, those are just energetically high states of quantum fields. So now that the energy is not too much, can I get an array of detectors, many of them, as many as I need, start doing things to the field, carrying out coupling with detectors strategically prepared, and encode information in the field, perhaps information about us, about the species, perhaps information that, assuming that after the bounce in the expansion, there would be another species that would develop the same kind of knowledge, maybe they would be able to reconstruct you. Maybe that's possible or maybe not. Maybe there are fundamental limits to it. But in principle, it's something worth exploring if you're that kind of civilization. Can we just encode ourselves in the fields so that we can teleport ourselves to the future? Someone can recover us if they have the level of technology that we have. Is that a possible thing? So the question is it possible? Can information encoded with detectors on fields survive a cosmological cataclysm? When you encode before the cosmological cataclysmic stage, and then you encode with detectors, and then you try to recover it later by doing the optimal possible in both cases. That's a question that we can formulate. So, right. Here's the thing. If we believe in quantum, information cannot be destroyed. It depends how much, how strongly you believe in quantum theory as it is now. Understood as unitarity, for sure. So within quantum theory, the best we can do with information to destroy it is something like this. Is that destroying the information? Not quite, no? It's doing something to it. It's scrambling it. It's making it difficult to put back together. That's what it's doing. It's increasing the difficulty of reading. A lot, maybe. A good scrambling may increase the difficulty of reading exponentially. But not erasing. Yeah, that you cannot do. You don't have tools in the quantum toolbox unless you assume the universe somehow has some non-trivial openness that is not related to higher systems. We have theorems. I mean, you probably have seen Steinsprung theorem, like dilation theorem, that even if you have a channel that decoheres, you can always purify that channel, considering that there's something else that is so that the whole thing is fully unitary. Now, there's divergence of opinions. Andrew wrote a paper not too long ago thinking that maybe unitarity, we are like too clinging too much to unitarity. I don't know. It's a matter of discussion, philosophical discussion even, if you want, whether clinging to unitarity is good or not. I personally like it. My personal view is, yeah, I like quantum theory. It's not perfect. It's the best we have. And within quantum theory, I haven't been presented ever a single time with that scenario where it makes more sense to me to consider that there's a loss of information. Black hole information loss problem? Not convinced that that's enough. And that's the only reason that, well, one of the big reasons that people try to have ever considered that maybe we have a non-trivial non-unitarity. Okay? Anyway, if we believe in quantum anyways, if we have a model which is a quantum bounce that may be triggered due to quantum gravity, but in which the metric remains the state of space that remains in a coherent state, so you have an effective metric at all times. So the density is not, it's big enough to have quantum corrections. You can have post-Einsteinian corrections, same way as you have post-Newtonian corrections when you correct Newtonian potentials with general relativity results. Imagine that you have a bounce that is post-Einsteinian, so you get some quantum gravity results, some modifications of the dynamics, that is not GR, a modification to the Friedman equations, the equations of motion of space-time when it's cosmology, coming from quantum gravity, but not strong enough for the effective description of geometry to break down. Okay, so you do a bounce, but it's not like really truly needing of more quantum than just a correction from quantum gravity. In that circumstance, we do have full unitarity. So I think, because it's 10 o'clock, I mean, for the first time, perhaps, I think it's worth finishing in time. Because I'm going to start something, so it's a nice point. So as quick, as brief summary. We're going to study this problem, the problem of how much information survives a quantum bounce, okay? And we cast it in a like jokingly kind of way, as in, well, imagine you're this civilization, and you want to save yourselves, and you know that there's going to be too much energy at some point density, and your atoms will not survive to it, your protons would not survive to it, so you want to maybe do something as in encoding information in the quantum field that will be scrambled by the bounce, but maybe someone in the future can recover it, okay? And how much of that information can be recovered? This is kind of the last topic that we're going to see within quantum collect calling. But it's called quantum collect calling. It's kind of interesting because I never told you why it's called quantum collect calling, like with detail. But I will tomorrow, hopefully. And the last thing that we're going to see in this block, other than finishing this, is now that we've seen signaling with particle detectors, we're going to see how the rotating wave approximation, it seems that I'm fixated with it. No, it's because it's really used a lot. How the rotating wave approximation breaks down the causality of the model. You have causality violations when you do the rotating wave approximation, strong ones. And those are the last two things we're going to see regarding the topics related to communication with using quantum fields as a medium. After that, the last topic that we have is quantum energy teleportation. And I hope that this is a fun one. We're going to talk a little bit about several topics, a little bit of thermodynamics, quantum thermodynamics that we need for that, a little bit of like fantastic results that Masahiro Hota developed, and then how to, in principle, use that to shape spacetimes with negative energy densities and things like that. And that's the rest of the course. All right, so I'll see you tomorrow.